leaders must understand the concepts around emotional intelligence, being able to manage and recognize their own emotions and process those, manage and recognize the emotions of others and how those emotions impact an environment and how those emotions inform decisions.
Hi, I'm Christine Shaw, CEO and President of Naylor Association Solutions, and I'm your host of the Association Advisor Podcast. We'll learn from successful association executives, partners, and clients on how to create a thriving, prosperous, and value-driven association. I invite you to join me in keeping informed and, most importantly, keeping your association profitable. Our goal is to leave you feeling inspired, more confident, and more knowledgeable. This is the Association Advisor Podcast.
Hi, and welcome back to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. I'm your host, Christine Shaw. In an ideal world, associations would always be thriving, hitting their goals, growing their memberships, and driving positive change. However, sometimes even the strongest associations can face tough challenges, whether that's an internal crisis, financial strain, or another major transition. We have the perfect guest to discuss this topic. Today's guest is Joy Calloway. Joy is the executive director of the National Medical Association, a group that champions African-American physicians and pushes for justice and equity in healthcare. With three decades of leadership experience, Joy has stepped into pivotal roles during times of transition, guiding organizations through uncertain waters and complex transitions. In our conversation, Joy shares what it takes to lead when the path forward is unclear and how to steer an organization through change with resilience and purpose. We'll also discuss her passion for equity in healthcare and the lessons other associations can take away from her journey. I've learned a lot from speaking with Joy, and I'm sure you will too. So let's dive in. Joy, welcome to the Association Advisor Podcast. I am so excited to have you on as a guest today.
Thank you, Christine. I'm glad to be here.
Fantastic. Well, I want our listeners to know a little bit more about you. So please tell a little bit about your background and your journey.
Sure. Absolutely. I love this question because there's so many different ways to go. As you said, Joy D. Calloway, I am currently the executive director and chief executive officer for the National Medical Association. We are an organization that represents the interests of the nearly 50,000 Black physicians in this country. And so I'm really excited to be in this role. I bring to it a little bit over 30 years of experience in nonprofit and healthcare leadership. My most recent experience, which I hopefully we'll get to talk about a little bit here, was as the interim president and CEO at Planned Parenthood of Greater New York during some really turbulent times. So I'm really excited to be here in this conversation. Love my work and my journey in nonprofit executive leadership and have parlayed that into what I consider to be a really fulfilling career.
You know, it must be fulfilling, and it's really interesting work you've done. So tell us a little bit about whether that's something you intentionally pursued or something that evolved just through opportunity.
So I will definitely start by saying it was not intentional. It's one of the things I love to say when I talk with young people or others that are looking to build their career. I was not, am not a strategic career builder. I don't have this goal of what I want to be in my last job before I retire and a step that I'll do this and then I'll do that. I'll move this way. I didn't do that. I looked for the next most fun job that will allow me to optimize my skill set and offer my best self, that will also teach me something and allow me to do the things that I love to do, which is solving problems, building successful teams, which is representing an organization. I love public speaking and being in the, you know, in the spotlight on behalf of the organization. So I wanted to start by saying that as far as moving into the interim experiences or what we call sometimes a crisis management experiences turnaround, I really think that was a recognition and something that people see in me when they see me work. They notice that I don't take things personally. You know, I'm able to compartmentalize. They notice that I'm a straight shooter. I talk very clearly and plainly about what needs to happen. They notice that I don't shy away from what we call courageous conversations or difficult conversations. I'm actually really good at working through conflict. I'm an efficient decision maker. I don't waste a lot of time trying to figure things out. And I couple that with the energy and excitement that I get from fixing problems, from running into the fire. There's something that I love there. And so when those two things come together, I get opportunities and I take them.
That's really fascinating to hear a leader like you. Just you're so self-aware of where your skills and strengths are, and then to be able to use them to solve problems. It's a great combination, as you said. Specifically, though, like you served as the interim president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Greater New York during a time of crisis and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
There are so many ways to approach that experience. I love the way this question was penned because it gave me a really good starting point. This question focuses on crisis and uncertainty. And I was in a place of crisis and uncertainty in my personal life at that time. I had just lost my parents 6 months and 10 days apart, and I was completely crushed. And so this opportunity came through an executive search person who had seen me do other work. So notice those things we talked about earlier in my work. And it gave me the opportunity to move to New York. I'm a Detroiter. I lived in Detroit at the time. And quite frankly, to be honest, I wish there was some grand plan that I could say I worked out. I needed to run away because home wasn't home anymore. I was in a place of crisis and uncertainty in my life, and this place that I was going to was in a place of crisis and uncertainty. So those two things, like magnets, it kind of drew me there. Put that on top of the things that I love: energy, excitement, running into the fire, problem solving, crisis management, straight talk, all of those things. And it was so technical term. The place was so jacked up. I'll tell you why in a moment, that it required so much of me. So in hindsight, maybe not the most healthy approach in that moment, but it worked for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have time to think about the feeling of being untethered, an adult orphan, alone, uncovered, because I put everything into Planned Parenthood. I moved there right at the height of the pandemic. Pandemic broke out in March. I moved to New York, the epicenter in this country, in October. I was literally one of three people on a subway at any given time because I was going in to the office. Everybody was masked and gloved and food getting delivered. I'm a theater girl and Broadway was shut down. So I only had focused time for that work. And so that really served me well. I'll tell you quickly that experience. So in January of that year, they had done a five-way merger, five different, we call them affiliates, merged together as one. And most people were unhappy with that. It's difficult enough to merge two organizations. Try merging five into one. So that happened in January. In March, COVID broke out. In April, they had a ransomware kind of situation that happened. In June, they very unceremoniously fired their chief executive officer, and they needed somebody to come and get this thing together in every area of that organization: programming, finances, image, marketing, every area, board, governance, everything was jacked up. And they needed somebody who was just in enough crisis and uncertainty herself to say, I'll give you everything I have because I don't want to think about that.
Wow. I can't even imagine. You know, I was myself in New York City as a CEO during that, and I left the city, right? Uh-huh. It was really difficult. So all those things coming together, a move, they say some of the most stressful things, right?
Absolutely.
And in a pandemic, right?
It was crazy.
Wow, that speaks a lot to who you are, Joy. So the next question is like, what are some of the essential skills for someone stepping in as an outsider? But my gosh, I think you just have such a unique skill set and persona that it's probably hard to emulate, but just tell us a little bit about what you think comes in handy or is required.
Of course. Your comment makes me think that everybody, every leader has their own unique set of skills, experiences that they bring, the timing. And one of the things I talk about when I teach or train or work with executive coaching clients is, you know, embrace the moment you're in and allow it to help guide and drive you through your leadership experience. We can talk about that more in a minute, but I think skill sets, one is more of a knowledge, piece of knowledge than a skill. Know that when you're going into a crisis management situation, when you're going into something where you are the outsider, know that it's going to be challenging. It's not going to be rainbows and unicorns, even on the best day, right? So you have to be prepared for that. And also in that knowing, know that you got to get your warm fuzzy somewhere else. right? So your best friends and your hugs and your uplift, your edification, the nurturing, the all of that, don't look for that in that role because they are looking to you to save the day. I don't know what how old you are. Mighty Mouse was a you. They want you to run in. I'm here to save the day, right? Yeah. So this is what people are expecting. So you can't go in there with your cup out like feed me, right? If you're fed as an offshoot of the work that you do, count it a blessing. But don't expect that. So the first thing is that knowing. I think from a skill set perspective, you have to be a trust builder early on. So you have to show up trustworthy. You have to show yourself dependable. You're going to do what you said you're going to do when you said you're going to do it. That is key to building trust and offering just enough vulnerability so people still sense the humanness. So it's not all superhero, like I'm coming to save the day, you know? And so I was very open with Planned Parenthood about the place I was in emotionally. Yeah. Right. And that humanized me, even in those times where like, who is this woman coming in here and what is she doing? And it humanizes you because everybody can relate to a loss. Maybe not yet, God willing, a loss of a parent, but everybody can relate to loss. And so that is important. I think it's important to be able, the ability to be able to quickly identify low-hanging fruit.
Absolutely.
Where can you go in and make something good happen really quickly so people notice and go, aha. So one of the things I do going into any new environment, especially crisis-wise, is listening sessions. I call them listening parties, town halls. It just depends on the culture of the organization, is to listen to as many groups of stakeholders as possible in a one-on-one. There, your bosses aren't in the room, your stakeholders, your patients aren't in the room. It's just us. Let's talk about what's important, what's working, what's not. Because even, as my daddy would say, a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah.
Right?
True. Right? I love that. I love that.
Just saying. So even the most jacked up technical term organization has some good stuff happening and you want to be able to come in and see those things, amplify those things, make sure people know that you see it because crisis managers come in, turnaround folks come in, fixers come in, and the expectations, they're going to point out all the stuff that's wrong.
Yeah.
So you got to flip that on its head. The other thing I would offer, two other things. One is clear and concise communication. You have to be a good communicator. Let people know what you're doing, why you're doing it, how you're going to do it, when you're going to do it. If something changes, let them know. I lean into over communicating. Mm-hmm. So that people know what to expect. They can't say you're hiding things. They can't say you're not being transparent. With that then comes the skill of understanding what tempered transparency means. Oftentimes in a crisis situation or a turnaround, there are things happening in the organization that is not appropriate for everybody in the organization to know, right? And folks might, well, you need to tell us how much this person, you need to tell us. You have to understand what you can share, when you can share it, and with whom to get the best result from a communicative standpoint. I'd also offer, there's a little bit of theater to it too. I happen to love musical theater, et cetera, so it works for me. You also have to know how to share information that you want to get around to people.
Absolutely.
Right? So there's a lot of communication skills. There's a lot of trust building skill. There's a lot of problem solving that I think are important going into those types of situations, Christine.
Yeah, there's a couple of things too, Joy, that you said I want to pick up on. I mean, one of them is, I love your advice when you're going someplace new to not depend on it. I actually recently had a leader who came in and experienced that. And it was a bit of a loss for this person. Like, I don't have my peer group, I don't have. And it was something that person had to adapt to. The other thing is listening. You're right. So many times we encounter a new person into an organization and all they want to do is be a change agent,
yep, without
understanding first and then communicating. Because what I have found in my own experience is even if you have to communicate something that's not good news, hearing it directly from the CEO or the leader is so critical because otherwise they create their own narrative.
That's right.
Worse is misinformation being put out there because of lack of communication.
Absolutely.
And people can then decide how they want to respond or what they're going to do with that information. Hey, this place isn't for me. Or, oh my God, I didn't realize this. I have ways I could help. And I have found that it's amazing how many people will step up and offer skills or solutions you didn't even know were possible just because
they understand it. And I want to lean in on one of the things that you said. One of the things we took to doing in our regular town hall meetings, there was an agenda item always at the beginning, usually at the beginning, that was myth busting.
Oh, I just did that. I literally just did
that. Don't you love that?
Boy, yes.
That is so powerful because they're like, I've always been one. Hear it from the horse's mouth. Even as a kid, it's like, well, somebody told me you said, I said, if you ever want to know what I said, ask me.
Yeah.
Right. Or I'm just the type, usually, you know, people say, I heard Christine said you don't like me. I said, guess what? I probably already told you that. Right.
Exactly.
You know, so I think that when a leader says, I know there's a rumor that blah, blah, blah is happening. People are one surprised that it got to you as the leader and that you're willing to address it straight on, because quite frankly, we all know every rumor has some shred of something that snowballed into the rumor.
Absolutely.
And that's really the nugget that people are looking for.
Yeah, that's great. We're very aligned there. So let's talk a little bit about some of your other experiences. So you've also led organizations from founding, including founding the first federally qualified health facility serving low-income populations, I believe in Oakland County, Michigan.
Oakland County, Michigan. Yes. And I love the approach of these questions because everything, whether you consider it a success or a failure, it teaches you something about yourself, about others, and about your leadership style. So I would think there are four or five things here. The first thing is that leaders have to be willing to get their hands dirty, right? So when I founded Oakland Primary Health Services in Oakland County, Michigan, I had a grant for $1 million and an empty building. That was it.
That was it.
So going in and really just starting to think about the vision of the collaborators that put the grant together, what they wanted to see, what reading the community needs assessment, what the community needed, and just sitting back in just a straight back chair at that point, because I had to bring something in to sit in every day, and just think about what we need to do to make all of that happen, right? And I had to be willing to do it. I had to be willing to learn about setting up telephone systems and obviously hiring people and, you know, decorate all of the things that come to creating a space that is warm and healing for our community. So the first thing, being willing to get your hands dirty. And that does teach you a lot about how to manage people, right? When you've had the opportunity to do a number of the different roles in the organization. I think leading directly from that is the importance of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, you know, having to go through, then it would have been the phone book back then, you know, to figure out, you know, who could be my IT person. I'm thinking, I know somebody that has an IT company. Let me call them, tell them what I need, see if they're the right person that can tell me who it is. I know HR people who know the fastest way to hire, you know, front desk folks. Let me call them. So relationships are really key because it saves you time. And you also have the trust built up with that person. This is not a sales thing, right? It gets to the point where, you know, your people will tell you, I could do this X, Y, and Z for you, but you don't need to do all that right now. You just need to do this. Right. And so that's the other thing, the importance of relationships. I think the third is the willingness to take risks. You can't win if you don't play. That was a commercial for the lottery when I was a kid. You can't win if you don't play, right? And so you have to be willing to take the risk, which goes back to an earlier point. This is not the place where I get my warm fuzzies, because when you take risks, sometimes you're going to fall on your face, or you're going to, you know, not do something right and upset somebody. You got to get your warm fuzzies and your edification, your uplift elsewhere. This is, okay, I gambled, I didn't win. You know, let me mitigate the loss and try again. So learning how to take risks. This is one that I don't get a chance to talk about often. I now require, sounds so diva-ish, but for lack of a better word, I now require that any board or selection committee, any group of people that are looking at me to hire me, it's got to be unanimous or I'm not going to join.
That's a good one. That's a really good one. Yeah.
Okay. And I learned that one the hard way. This particular organization, the way federally qualified health centers are set up, half the board is, you know, business. The other 51% of the board has to be community consumers, right? And so this was in Pontiac, Michigan. I'm a Detroiter. And so that matters, right? We used to call Pontiac Little Detroit. They didn't like that. But, you know, so the business side, the corporate side of the board was all in. Got this girl, 3 degrees from University of Michigan. She's done this, 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 and this. Let's take her. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Community is like, who is this chick? She's not from here.
Right.
I didn't know. That was my first CEO role. So this whole time, there's been this push and pull. There's this people that were rah-rah joy and these other people that were side-eyeing joy. And so there's always this push and pull. So now I say, if it's not unanimous, then don't bring me in, because I don't want to start out in a fight. I'm going to have to fight the process, the problems, the issues, perhaps some of the employee, you know, I don't want to have to fight with the folks that are supposed to be my guiding light and my strategist partner.
And you're smart to do that and to ask that, because you're right. Going into those types of situations, you're going to be making unpopular decisions.
That's right.
You're already going to have detractors, and you can't have them
coming in the door. The last thing I'll offer, because it ties to that, this is where, and I always said, I got to write a book called The Proper Care and Feeding of Your Board, because they didn't teach me that at the B school in Michigan. Okay. You're a CEO. You know, there's something about that board engagement that we need to go together and write this book, because that job taught me not only that 51% thing wasn't serving me, got to have a unanimous decision, but also there are nuances to board relationship development. There are nuances to board life cycle, board member life cycles. And you have to understand those things if you're going to be an optimally effective leader. So that's what I learned there, and a number of other things, but those are the ones that initially came to mind. A great experience. I'm glad I did it. Like all the things in my resume, there's nothing, even in the places where it wasn't rainbows and unicorns, it was well worth the experience and the time and effort.
Yeah. And Joy, you know, the thing about satisfying, feeding, nourishing your board, what a lot of people aspiring to be leaders or CEOs don't realize is that is equally as important as the day-to-day management of your people. And I feel like there should be more training and learning and coaching on that, because it's so critical to the success of your journey.
Totally agree.
And the other thing you talked about too is relationships. The part of it that I always like to emphasize is sometimes I think people get in a leadership role and they believe they should know everything and know all the answers. It's okay to use your network.
They like that.
They like that. And you should ask for help if you don't
have
that resource, because it's going to make you a stronger, better leader than to think you have to be the coming up as, you know, Wonder Woman or Mighty Mouse. That's really good advice. Really good.
And I think the point at which you recognize that I don't have to know everything, I need to know how to find everything.
Exactly.
The moment you recognize that, it's very freeing, because I came into the work world, like most of us do, out of graduate school, and I've got these two master's degrees and from this place, and I'm supposed to know this. And I was mortified. I was so scared to ask questions. And I think about it now, I was like 24.
Right? Yeah. And I think we all go through that a little bit, and that ties a lot to imposter syndrome and all that. So I'm glad you shared that.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about your current role as the executive director of the National Medical Association. Mm-hmm. So the mission is centered on justice and equality and equity in healthcare. So as a woman in a leadership position, how has this experience influenced this mission?
So I'd have to qualify that a little bit as a Black woman in healthcare.
Yes.
That really is the qualifier, because right now I work with Black physicians. And so we are able to have conversations at a level that's different than we might be able to in mixed company and able to move those things forward. But in roles past, that hasn't been the case. And I have had to, in a couple pretty prominent situations, had to very much lean into the fact that, you know, as a Black woman in this community at this space and time, I understand some things about this problem we're trying to solve that you don't. And so I had to very much lean in as a young leader in one particular case to really make sure my voice was heard and be courageous in that, knowing that I was taking a professional risk by doing so. And so that's an experience that I've brought on, because there are risks to bringing things up, and certain environments are right now in the world, conversations about equity, diversity, inclusion, belonging, all of that. We're in a challenging time to have those conversations right now. And so as that is the backbone of my organization, it requires me to continue to be courageous and unapologetic about the needs of the Black community in healthcare. I was thinking about this question. That's probably the primary piece that I have lived this my entire life. I've been a healthcare kid for 30 some years. I've been a Black woman for longer than that. And so I've been in these communities. I understand these communities. And in the places where my blessed privilege separates me from, I figure out ways to go deeper. so that I can make sure that I am understanding and speaking on behalf of and representing the needs of the communities that we serve. The other thing I'll say about this question, the first thing that came to my mind is not so much being a woman in this position, but being a non-physician has been more probably challenging in some cases than anything else, because, you know, I work with physicians. Yep. And then you add the layer of Black physicians who've had to go through a whole nother road to hoe, as the old people would say, than their non-Black counterparts. And so there is a certain expectation and attitude and ego, and I mean it just definitionally, ego that comes with that, that I've had to navigate. That has been the bigger navigation. And having to be in a place where I say, my folks are sick of hearing it now, but I've had to say as professionally and respectfully and lovingly as possible, the same 30 years you spend in the exam room, I spend in the boardroom, right? And so I don't come into the exam room trying to explain to you how to do your things. I can tell you my perspective as a patient in your exam room. Likewise, I don't expect that there's going to be a heavy hand into the work that I'm doing. I expect your perspective as a member and as a professional, but we've got to respect those boundaries. And I think that's been more challenging than not, than others.
Well, it's a credit to you that you've navigated that as well as you have, and look at where you are today. So that's a great example to set for others in similar situations. Let's talk about one of the initiatives your organization have is the National Colloquium on African-American Health. It mm-hmm. brings your members together with legislators to discuss advocacy for health policies. So tell us a little bit about what makes this so successful as an event every year.
Thank you for asking. Our colloquium in 2025 is going to be March 27th through the 30th. It's at the Capitol Hill Hilton. And I expect that we're going to be open registration for that, I think, the 1st of January. What makes this successful? One is we built a really good track record of having compelling programming, compelling topics, of having leading experts in the various fields, both on the healthcare side and on the legislative side, the policymaking side. And so people expect a robust program, and it's usually 3 days of programming. So people expect that. It's exciting. And so we built that track record up. I think what else makes this exciting and successful is people also know we have lots of opportunities for engagement, not only with each other, our members from all around the country. We're obviously a nationwide organization with some international work, 6 regions across the country. So this is one of those 3 times a year where we have a national convening to bring people together. So that networking experience with each other as members and also with our legislators, it's something that people look forward to. And we are purposeful. We did a really good job this year, purposeful to have not just panel discussions with Q&A, but some actual work sessions where our members, our key stakeholders, our legislators are working together to solve problems. This colloquium is designed to present, educate on, raise awareness about our health policy foci for the year. Another thing I think that makes it successful is we have what I call our perennial topics. Like, we're Black doctors. We're always going to be talking about infant and maternal mortality and morbidity. We're always going to talk about health disparities in Black communities. We're always going to be talking about health equity. We are always going to be talking about the importance of voting as a public health imperative. We are always going to be talking about violence as a public health issue, whether it be intra-community violence or police-based violence in our community. So there's certain things that we're always going to talk about. And then there are things that are brought to us each year as our new president comes in, or as the things happen in the world and we've got to talk about it. We've got to talk about 340B right now. We've got to talk about PDABs, prescription drug advisory boards. So there's certain things that come up. Clinical diversity or diversity in clinical trials is always going to be something we talk about. And there's a lot of conversation about that right now. So the success comes from the track record, the networking, the subject matter experts, and from knowing that they're going to have an opportunity to learn, engage, connect around really pithy issues. Finally, they know there's going to be a call to action. I've only been around a couple of years, and each time we've made sure, I believe it was happening prior to me being here with this team, but there's always, so what now? What are you going to do when you leave here on Saturday night, on Sunday morning? How are you going to take this message, these messages back to your local communities, your districts, your patients, and what are we going to do with it?
It sounds like a great event. No wonder
it is.
Your passion comes through loud and clear on that. So I know that the upcoming event will be just as successful. Now, you have also done some speaking as well as consulting. You've addressed audiences on topics like mental health, emotional intelligence, board development, as we talked about a little bit earlier. So tell us a little bit of your key lessons that you would offer to other leaders on these topics.
Each of those topics can be its own podcast, okay? Keep me in mind. Let's see, top lines on mental health, near and dear to my heart. And that would be, I feel like I said this a little bit in another way, is to embrace the valleys. And by that, I don't necessarily just mean the valleys in your life, but the valleys in your mental and emotional wellness. We tend to shy away from those places, just human nature. We don't like things that don't feel good. We don't want to spend time there. But the valleys of life, the valleys in your mental wellness and emotional wellness give you a perspective that you don't have from the mountaintop. And so that I think is the top line, is embrace those valleys, recognize that you are responsible for your mental and emotional wellness. And as things are happening around you, you have to make the decisions that keep you in the driver's seat when it comes to maintaining and improving your mental and emotional wellness. So that would be the top lines for mental health. I think the top line for emotional intelligence, one of my favorite things to teach and train on, is that it is as important, if not more important, than technical skills sometimes.
I preach that all the time, Joy. That is an evolution, because you know, years ago when I started my career, that wasn't even a thing. We didn't talk about it. And now, not only do we talk about it, it's a requirement. And any recruiter or any company searching for a leader, it's absolutely table stakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We used to be in the place where you leave your emotions at home, and that's, they're a part of us, right? And so that was, you know, we did what we could at the time and we did what we thought was right at the time. But we now know that we leaders must understand the concepts around emotional intelligence, being able to manage and recognize their own emotions and process those, manage and recognize emotions of others and how those emotions impact an environment and how those emotions inform decisions. So I think the top line there is just, you know, making this something that is part of your toolkit and something you are always working on, because in that we don't leave our emotions at home when we show up as a leader. And we'll talk about this in a minute with another question. Where I am in my mental and emotional wellness at any given moment impacts how I'm leading that day.
Absolutely.
And I got to get that. I got to know that. The other piece right alongside that is self-awareness. That is where we really mess up as leaders, right? We got these great technical skills and maybe you've climbed the ladder and now you're in this great role. But if you don't know yourself, you don't know where you are in your mental and emotional wellness, you don't know where you are in your skill set in this particular area, then it's going to negatively impact your leadership. So that's it.
But, you know, also you're writing a book at the moment, One Crisis from Crazy, which I love. Thank Finding you. Myself Without Losing My Mind. Can we get a little sneak peek into what inspired the book? Although I think I have some ideas.
You have some ideas from talking to me already. So One Crisis from Crazy is a speaking platform that I've used for a number of years. And now I'm turning that into a book, a memoir that looks at mental and emotional wellness and my journey toward accepting the hills and valleys in my own mental and emotional wellness. What inspired that was being surrounded by amazing, fabulous, highly successful, you know, C-suite Black women is the inspiration, who, as I say, have everything. They look the part, they got the four H's, they got the right house, the right husband, the right heels, the right handbag, all of this.
I love that.
And yet inside, they were falling apart because it took so much energy to keep, you know, manifesting that fabulosity, that they weren't acknowledging and dealing with their own mental and emotional challenges. And so that was the inspiration for that. And I recognized that, you know, across my life, and I think I really realized it when I read my birthday journal on my 50th birthday. I keep a birthday journal. I spend time on every birthday writing for hours sometimes in my journal. When I turned 50, I grabbed my journal. It was about a 10-year stretch of time on the beach, and I read through it. And I realized, Christine, that I lived with depression. Never diagnosed. Yeah. Only medicated after I lost my mom. And I just watched that, you know, from the outside looking in, things looked like they were happening fabulously, right? And I did a really good job of being what I call the whiz. Like, you stay on the other side of that curtain and just listen to my big voice and be impressed with me. And I realized that that wasn't healthy for me and it wasn't serving its purpose, right? So bear with me here. I sincerely believe, even when I'm in it and it doesn't feel like it, that our life challenges are partly for us, but they are also for other people. If you allow people, Christina, look at you and all your fabulosity of your life, and they think you're perfect, and they're looking at this perfect person who never shares the things that challenge you, I would offer, my upbringing would offer, that you're not living out your true purpose, because half the stuff we go through is for other people because they're watching it. They need to see us, this perfect person who, oh my gosh, you filed bankruptcy or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that, Joy, too, because I think sometimes when strong, successful women are out in the world, people think that they've got it all together and they couldn't possibly believe that there's some vulnerability or along the way you made a mistake or dealt with something. And oftentimes what I have found out is people say, oh, like I've lost both my parents. I've gone through some things too. And people go, oh, I didn't even think you would want me to.
Exactly.
You seem so strong and confident and all that. Like, and I'm like, oh, okay. But I'm a human. There's still feelings. And I think that that's so important because think about the message when you were saying earlier, like before, you know, we're similar generations. It's like that leave your emotions, you know, at home with you. Think of how unhealthy that is.
Yes.
They're pretending, just be robots. So
that's right. That's right.
Well, I am looking forward to reading that book. And speaking of books, we always close out our episode by asking our guests to recommend a book so that others can continue learning after the episode.
Sure. I'm going to give you a little run up to this before I answer it. I read all the time. I love reading. Right now, I'm reading a number of different memoirs, and I usually read two or three books at a time because I'm writing a memoir. So it's fun to be in the place.
Yeah.
My book that I'm going to share is the book that I am reading. I started it probably a couple of years ago, and I'm still trying to work it through. It is called Grief is Love by Marissa Renee Lee.
Oh, okay.
And I recognize that the energy and essence that is joy, the authenticity that is joy in all my roles is muted in some way by my incomplete grief. And so I'm challenging myself to finish this book and complete my grief process.
Yep.
The grief journey is forever because grief is love. I will never stop loving them.
You know, I have to say two things. When you first started talking about how you got into your role and the crisis you were going through, in my head, I kept thinking, but she needs to grieve. She needs to figure that out. Like, you need to still take care. And even though that's how you dealt with it in the moment, it doesn't erase that.
Not at all.
So I'm glad to hear you say that.
Beautiful book. Woman lost her mom. So it was really, and again, I tried a number of, I've gone through the little steps and all of that, and I just couldn't get through it. This one does speak to me. And I believe this will be what cracks the nut and kind of gets me to that next place.
Well, Joy, this has been a great, great conversation. It was really touching in many ways. And so thank you for opening yourself personally, as well as sharing professionally, because I think that we all have to blend our personal and professional lives.
We must.
To be authentic, as you said. Thank you so much.
You too. Take care, Christine.
Thank you for listening to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. If you'd like to access more resources to serve your association needs or join our newsletter, you can visit our website at naylor.com or just click the links in the show notes of this episode. Please be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast listening app, like Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcast, so you won't miss an episode. Also, I'd love to hear from my listeners directly. Feel free to email me at christine@naylor.com. Until next time, we at Naylor are wishing your association success.